Prologue. An enigmatic telegram arrived at the port of Dover just past midnight. It was in code, so its meaning would have been lost on anyone save for its intended recipient, an officer named Superintendent Bordeaux. "Where could second letter find you?" the telegram read. It was on the 5th of August, 1914, and Bordeaux began urgent preparations as he waited for a second message to confirm his orders. "We were taking considerable risk," he noted in a melodramatic handwritten report buried deep in the archives of Britain's post office. At 1:52 a.m., Bordeaux was on board a ship, the Alert, as it set sail. The bulk of the crew were ignorant as to their mission. The weather was still good. War had been declared with Germany just minutes before the telegram had been sent. The Alert was about to undertake the first offensive act of the conflict. The Alert arrived at its first destination at 3:15 a.m., lowered its hook to the seabed, and began to dredge. After 20 minutes, it had hauled up the end of a cable. Bordeaux had been instructed to bring it to the surface to check it was the right one. Then he was to cut it. By the time a fourth cable was reached, it was 6 in the morning. Heavy rain and wind were battering the ship, making the grappling much harder. At this moment, a foreign ship was spotted for the first time. With relief, Bordeaux realized it was from Britain's ally France. "Alert, what are you doing?" the curious French captain asked as he pulled up alongside. "Cutting German cables," Bordeaux replied with disarming honesty for a man on a secret mission. He and his crew then gave us a splendid round of cheers, which we heartily replied, Bordeaux writes. By 10 in the morning, the Alert was heading back to Dover. The Alert's order had come by telegram, the near instantaneous form of communication that had transformed everyday life in the previous half century by sending an electrical signal down a wire to deliver a message. The telegraph had been the driving force in the first wave of globalization. It allowed businessmen, diplomats, and ordinary people to communicate with each other across vast distances in a matter of moments rather than weeks or months. It had brought the world so close together that optimists believed it had banished the possibility of conflict. But Europe was now descending into the abyss of the First World War, and in carrying out the order sent by telegram, Bordeaux and the Alert were undertaking one of the first strategic acts of information warfare in the modern world, an act whose consequences would ripple out in unforeseen ways through the war years and beyond, leading to the birth of modern communications intelligence. The Alert had cut off almost all of Germany's communications with the outside world. It had hit the kill switch. On the 4th of August, just before the Alert set sail, a man arrived at the cable station at Porthcurno in Cornwall. On the secluded sandy beach, telegraph cables carrying traffic across the Atlantic came ashore, and the messages they conveyed would then be relayed from inside the building. The man's job title was not one that we associate with espionage. He was a censor. In the office of the Eastern Telegraph Company in the British colony of Hong Kong, another secret censor walked into his new office. A similar figure did the same in every far-flung corner of empire, from Malta to Singapore. Once the censors were in position, instructions had told them to send a message to London reading, "Fixity, London, fixed." The system was up. At midnight on the 2nd of August, 1914, a global system of interception had been instituted. Known as censorship, its aim was to prevent intelligence being conveyed to the enemy and to cut off the enemy's correspondence with his agents. Britain was taking advantage of its control of much of the international telegraph infrastructure to create the first global communications surveillance system from Cairo to Cape Town, from Gibraltar to Zanzibar. 50,000 messages would pass through the hands of 180 censors at UK offices alone every single day. Another 400 worked in 120 stations overseas. In all, 80 million messages would be subject to censorship during the war. Spy fever had gripped the country as war approached. This had been fueled by lurid tales from novelists and newspapers suggesting German agents were lurking undercover in every port and village, secretly conveying vital information back to the fatherland that might cost Britain victory. The fears led to the creation of MI5 to catch German spies at home and MI6 to make sure the favor was being returned. It was hoped that the censorship of telegraph cables would help catch those largely non-existent agents. And some men would meet their deaths, blindfolded and shot in the moat of the Tower of London, based on the letters and telegrams that were intercepted. The impetus of war and the fear of the unknown would lead to intelligence collection on an industrial scale. An army of vans pulled up outside Strand House in London and unloaded bags of international mail onto trolleys. Bulk intercept in the pre-computer age was low-tech and laborious. The building was damp, cold, poorly ventilated and cramped, declassified files record with some sadness, and a full-time nurse was on duty to limit the high sickness and absence rates. The task of reading other people's mail was so vast that it spilled out of Strand House and into even the new Science Museum in South Kensington. At its peak, 375,517 letters were censored in a single day. At the end of the war, it was reckoned that 630 million letters had passed through the system, with 1.3 million of them stopped for further checks. How were these selected? Letters to and from certain addresses and names on a blacklist were intercepted, the most sensitive being sent straight to MI5. There was mission creep as the system expanded from looking for German agents to keeping track of anarchists, finding obscene literature, and even information on political matters from well-informed private individuals. Members of Parliament could have their posts stopped, since discontented soldiers at the front frequently communicated their concerns and supposedly sensitive information by letter. This was all about international mail. There were trials of blanket interception of domestic letters as part of the pursuit of spy rings, but installing sensors at every local post office would be too obvious and generate too much material to process. The technology did not yet exist to facilitate such an ambition. The latest piece of communications equipment, the telephone, added a new complication. Phoning Europe required permission from the cable censor's office. In naval towns like Sheerness, Devonport, and Harwich, all domestic calls were listened to and transcribed in the hunt for enemy agents. A single line in the official report summarizes the results. Nothing of any value was discovered. Intercepting mail with Germany was fair game, but what about neutral countries? In May 1915, a warrant was signed for the interception of all mail coming from or heading to America. A whole new office in Liverpool was opened to cope with the volume, and by the end of the war, America accounted for 10 times as much material as any other neutral country, and well over half the total. Britain was learning that reading someone's messages to glean intelligence might be more useful than stopping them communicating. Just as modern commerce depends on the internet, international trade then depended on the telegraph. Clever detective work could help expose German attempts to evade the economic blockade. Was a company in Amsterdam seeking to buy metal from America really a front for the German firm Krupps? If so, it would be placed on the secret blacklist. The next step was using this intelligence as a weapon. When the Irving National Bank of New York was found to be conducting a little too much business with Germany, its cables were delayed until it changed its behavior. The same trick was used on all commercial traffic to the Netherlands because the Dutch were allowing sand, gravel, and cement for the German war effort to transit. This, a British official remarked, inflicted an infinity of harm until they agreed to stop. When the alert severed telegraph cables, it did not cut Germany off completely. There was the new medium of radio. Germany had invested in a high-powered, kilometre-long radio antenna at Nauen. For the German and British navies, radio was changing warfare, allowing ship-to-shore communication for the first time and centralised command and control. And German radio would be the crucial stimulus to the conception of Britain's communications intelligence machine. A decade before the war, the Eastern Telegraph Company had set up a radio receiver on a small headland above Porthcurno Beach, still known as Wireless Point. It was there to spy on the transmissions of Guglielmo Marconi, the flamboyant businessman and inventor who had just sent a radio message across the Atlantic. The Eastern Telegraph Company feared this new upstart technology would destroy their business. But radio had a problem. It was a broadcast medium. Anyone with a receiver could listen in. Surely that meant it was insecure for any sensitive communication. Marconi had claimed it would be possible to transmit on a narrowly defined wavelength to stop people tapping a message. To prove him wrong, the Eastern Telegraph Company turned to a magician. At a June 1903 lecture at the prestigious Royal Institution, Marconi's team was supposed to pick up a secure message from Cornwall in front of a packed crowd, but just before the agreed time, an assistant started to hear a rogue signal. He realized with horror that the word rats was being spelt out in Morse code. A rhyme followed. There was a young fellow of Italy who diddled the public quite prettily. Word soon seeped out that Marconi had been, to use the modern term, hacked. The culprit was Neville Maskelyne, the magician in the pay of the Eastern Telegraph Company, who had interfered with Marconi's communication to show it was not secure. The lesson was that radio was subject to interception. That meant security was going to have to be integrated into the message itself rather than relying on the mode of transmission. That required secret codes, and where there were codes, there would be code breakers. On the first day of the war, the Director of Naval Intelligence took Sir Alfred Ewing, a man with shaggy eyebrows and an academic bent, to lunch. A Marconi Company engineer was delivering messages intercepted from Germany on a specially chartered train to Liverpool Street Station in London. Some were in code, and a team was needed to decipher them. Ewing was asked to take charge. "These were the decipherers, and a rummier set of fellows I never came across in all my born days," one observer said of the men who would assemble under him in room 40 of the Admiralty Building. The magnificently named Fleet Paymaster Charles Rotter, a naturalized German, was the first to tackle the gobbledygook of encoded messages. The Germans, as did the British, used code books, which were like a dictionary shared between sender and recipient, with a list of common words and phrases and a corresponding code to substitute for them. Rotter and his team had got hold of all three main German code books and began to decipher German communications. The First Lord of the Admiralty, Winston Churchill, was a man who loved intrigue and intelligence, and he immediately grasped the enormous potential. In November 1914, he issued a charter marked Exclusively Secret. Room 40 would study messages, past and present, in order to penetrate the German mind. Churchill would have decoded messages rushed in to him as he was having his morning bath. He would then grip them with a dripping hand. Spies had pilfered letters for kings and generals for hundreds of years, but Churchill's charter marked the emergence of something new. This was communications intelligence as a formalized discipline, the systematic gathering, classifying, processing, and decoding of messages. When used correctly, it was a powerful tool for both the soldier and the diplomat. A decoded German message known as the Zimmermann Telegram would help bring America into the war by revealing Berlin's plans to offer chunks of U.S. territory to Mexico. British codebreakers also learnt that sometimes you did not need to actually break a code to extract useful intelligence. German Zeppelins were bringing the war to the home front by dropping bombs on British towns, but it emerged that when an airship took off, messages would be sent to German anti-aircraft guns so that they would not fire on it. The Zeppelin would also use regular call signs to report back as it cruised over the North Sea and asked for bearings. You might not be able to break those codes, but if you systematically analyzed their behavior over time, you could begin to predict when the Zeppelin was taking off and what its path might be, an early form of geolocation based on communications data. That would then allow you to alert your anti-aircraft guns at the right positions to get ready. This type of intelligence, studying the externals of a message for value, became known as traffic analysis. Once inside your enemy's communications, you could also deceive. During one raid, false bearings were signaled to send Zeppelins off course, allowing them to be shot down over France. Just as the war was ending, the first sign was emerging of something new that would supplant the centuries-old practice of code books. On the 23rd of February 1918, an engineer named Arthur Scherbius, whose other inventions included an electric pillow, filed patent number 416129 in Berlin. The German military could not yet see the potential of his new device, but after the war, Scherbius would sell it to businesses with the slogan, "One secret, well protected, may pay the entire cost of the machine." Confident of its ability to create a mystery that other people could not understand, Scherbius christened the electromechanical device Enigma. The era of machines was arriving. In the east end of London, a boy stood in his front garden during the war. He could see a searchlight scanning the dark skies above. He was a working-class bricklayer's son, not quite in his teens, who loved to tinker with toy steam engines and build things with mechanosets. As he gazed up into the night sky, he saw the menacing form of a dark, bomb-laden Zeppelin, suddenly illuminated by a searchlight, perhaps spotted with the help of the codebreakers. Guns opened up from the ground and the hulking mass was brought down over London in a flaming wreck. By the time of the next war, young Tommy Flowers would build his own machine, a creature made up of hot valves and paper tape, a machine that would not only help win the war, but take the world into the computer age.